Greece is cheap.
But the airfare costs a fortune.
Paris?
Not much closer, and again, airfare...
What about Puerto Vallarta?
Let's face it, flying anywhere is just too expensive.
Wait, what's this? Low-cost airlines.
With one call to low-cost airlines, you'll drastically slash your travel costs. We're talking insanely low airline prices to any of your favorite destinations. Where would you like to go? London, Rome, Costa Rica, Australia?
Wow, that's cheap.
So why wait? Call now to learn how crazy cheap it is to fly anywhere in the U.S. or international. Our prices are so low, we can't publish them. The only way to get them is to call to instantly hear the most amazing best deals on airline travel. It's that easy. So call now and start packing.
800-217-5107. 800-217-5107. 800-217-5107. That's 800-217-5107.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. How China's authoritarianism is undermining its rise, a contrarian look inside China. That's tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Carl Minzer is a professor of law at Fordham University Law School. He's an expert in Chinese law and governance and has written extensively on these topics in both academic journals and the popular press, this one designed for the popular media. His new book, End of an Era, How China's Authoritarian Revival is Undermining Its Rise. And welcome from Fordham, Carl. How are you?
Very good. Thanks so much for having me on the show, Jim.
No, it's our honor. I'm particularly impressed how able you were to get inside the psyche and the DNA of China, which obviously we're going to talk about later. And I want to ask first off, what's your perspective on these tariffs that the President Trump has just put on, 25% steel, 10% aluminum, and really targeted at China? What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly it looks to me like we're seeing an era in which, you know, the conflicts between the United States and China over trade are likely to heat up. And Trump does seem to be pivoting away from an era in which the United States was interested in free trade and multinational accords. It seems to be likely to ramp up conflict with China on this, you know, in the short term.
Do you think that there's a big threat of retaliation from them, making it a zero-sum game? And with that, the Chinese are estimated through intellectual property theft and espionage affecting us negatively to the tune of $300 billion a year. Is that the real issue?
I certainly think that it's likely that China is going to... It's hard for me to imagine how if Trump went through with a series of tariffs, the Chinese aren't likely to just take that line down. They're likely to come back with something. On what subject, I don't know. Would it be hitting soybeans? Would it be hitting? I suspect they'll sort of pick something that's going to be aimed at sending a political message to Trump's base and Republican congressmen. But specifically, what they would go after, I don't know.
Okay. China's always had this long-term focus, and the question is whether it's 2030 or 2050, would they surpass us in GDP? We have a very short-term focus. Does it matter if they surpass us, do you think? And before we get into your thesis, are they maybe not going to pass us?
Well, I think there are a couple different questions about that. I mean, one, and the sort of the one I'm on my book, is sort of what's happening domestically in China? What's the politically, ideologically, and economically, what's going on in terms of the shifts that are taking place in China at this moment? And I think that I am seeing some fundamental changes in the political norms that have governed China since the early 1970s, since the late 1970s, early 1980s, that make me worried about the stability of the system going forward. China is also experiencing big economic shifts. I think it is secularly starting to slow down. It's following on the same trajectory that Japan and South Korea and Taiwan have gone through. It's possible that, you know, China, you know, may surpass the United States in terms of overall GDP. It's going to be a very long time before it even comes remotely close to approaching the United States in per capita GDP.
Yes.
But I think the really big thing to watch is some of the political changes that are starting to take place in China right now, because they're really different from what we've seen over the last 40 years.
That leads to the obvious first question. President Xi Jinping, is he president for life now?
It certainly looks like he's setting himself up in that direction. I mean, since the late 1970s, early 1980s, China, unlike the Maoist era, had pursued a policy of collective leadership. Unlike Mao, Deng Xiaoping and his successors ruled the country in sort of a, you know, with power shared among a group of leaders. What's happened over the last 5 years is Xi Jinping has steadily removed and curtailed any other alternative power centers within the party itself. At the party congress last fall, they didn't appoint a successor to him, which you would have expected after his end of his 10-year term in office in 2023. And then just a couple weeks ago, they removed the formal term limits on his role as president, which is a clear signal that he intends to continue on even after 2023.
Another big picture kind of question on the psyche of China. What do you find the morale of the people and sort of the social fabric?
So I think that's an excellent question. And China is a big country. There are many different people with, it's just like the United States. You have a range of different views among people themselves. So just in terms of general national pride, many people in China are proud that their country has stood up after, 100, 150 years of being sort of relegated to second or third place in the world, second or third tier rank within the world. They now feel, look, China is actually, being taken seriously abroad, and that's a sense of pride. At the same time, many people are also concerned about some of these shifts. There are people who remember an earlier era in China in which politics was much more unstable, and they look at some of the recent developments and think, what does this mean for the future? Within China, the economic development also plays out in different ways. Just like the United States, there are people who have had their lives improved dramatically as a result of the last 4 years. There are also people who have left and left behind. There are migrant laborers who feel like my life might have gotten a little bit better, but there are certainly more people who have done incredibly well. You have recent college graduates who feel like their job prospects aren't remotely what they expected. And so there's a real split that's developing in China right now between the people who feel things are getting better, but then also people who feel like, no, it's not getting better for me.
Sounds like us, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting that you call this the end of an era. The era of reform is over. You know, to those of us in the West, China looks solid and monolithic, and it's masking these weaknesses, apparently, that you see. Tell us what you mean by the era of reform is over.
Sure. So when I say the end of the reform era, I'm pretty careful. I mean, the term reform in China is nearly sacrosanct. So whatever happens going forward, even if it's major policy reversals, it's going to be cloaked in the language of reform. And if you mean reform is just change happens in any society. So that's kind of, but I think if you're using the term reform era, you're thinking about the last 30 or 40 years in China, which is what we think of as China, post-1978, in which the economy has been growing really rapidly. Ideologically, it's been relatively open to the outside world. And politically, it's been relatively stable. Unlike the Maoist era, you've had norms internally within the party that have sort of made the rules of the game with the one-party system somewhat more predictable. And what worries me now is I see all three of those things beginning to go. Politically, those collective leadership norms, the avoidance of a cult of personality, that's steadily one after another, those things are breaking down. Economically, the system is beginning to slow. The optimists will say, well, it's just a secular slowing down. It's like other East Asian tigers. It'll drop down to sort of a lower level. The pessimists are flagging things like the buildup in debt or worried about a more dramatic slowing. And ideologically, whereas in the early 1980s, China was very interested in absorbing things from the outside, I'm sensing a closing up in that sense. The party itself is beginning to pivot back to a more narrow definition of what it means to be Chinese. And they're starting to look with more suspicion at a range of foreign influences, both Western liberal norms, Christian house churches, but foreign businesses that have started to come under pressure that they didn't really expect 20 years ago.
You made, I think, a really insightful point that the U.S. tends to fundamentally misunderstand political transition. You cite Soviets when they collapsed in 91, Iraq, 2003, even Egypt more recently, 2011. So is that a statement that we kind of don't understand what's going on in China, really?
I think there's a little bit of that. I think there's in some ways we automatically assume that economic development automatically has to mean that people are going to be more like us, you know, more automatically result in a liberal democratic society. And I don't think that's true. I also tend to think that we believe Americans tend to think, well, when anytime an authoritarian system collapses, sort of the seeds of democracy just automatically spring out. And I don't think that's true either. I think transitions can be very tricky and very complicated. And so, you know, things move forward and move backwards. And I think China may not be going exactly where we hoped or we wanted, but it's pursuing its own. And there's an internal trajectory that's taking place in China. We just have to sort of look and see what's happening and whether we like it or not, just realize that that's where China's going.
Was the 1989 Tiananmen Square protest, what was the beginning of this ending of the reform period?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good question. I think there were different key points that took place. I do think 1989 was one. In the 1980s, the question as to how far China might go with political reform was a little bit more open. There were some serious experimentations with deeper political reform at that point, but by 1989... that was all off the table. The bloody crushing of the pro-democracy movement put an end to that. After that, there was still some possibility for more limited reforms, but I think even those, you saw those begin to peter out by the early 2000s. So it was kind of a slow closing of the door on the possibility for deeper institutional change, and 1989 was a key moment.
Listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Go to biztalkradio.com, find the station closest to you, listen over the Internet, and access our podcast. We'll be talking more on the decline of China coming right up. Stay with us.
Have you heard about Biz TV? Biz TV is the home for America's entrepreneurs, small businesses, and those who want to succeed in life. It's the first national television network committed to airing original, high-quality, educational, and inspirational programming about real business people. Small businesses drive America forward, generating 64% of all new jobs in the last decade. With over 30 million small businesses in the U.S., shouldn't you be watching Biz TV? With the right kind of ideas, motivation, and education to help fuel the next generation of business owners, Biz TV is the network you should be watching. Success stories, new ideas turned into businesses, programs full of sales tips, goal setting, how to manage, how to raise capital, and improving work-life balance. Biz TV is for those who want to succeed. Visit biztv.com and call your satellite or cable service provider to request Biz TV.
We paid less for our Craftmatic today than we did 20 years ago.
If you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and free information on today's Craftmatic adjustable beds. And then decide when you see how little they cost. Rated number one by consumers nationwide on ConsumerAffairs.com. Craftmatic beds come in all mattress types, including cool gel memory foam for up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand. Enjoy temporary relief of low back pain, poor circulation, nighttime heartburn, mild arthritis. You'll sleep better in a Craftmatic adjustable bed. So if you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and information, and then decide when you see how little they cost. Discover Craftmatic for less, up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand.
Call 1-800-316-5271. That's 1-800-316-5271. 1-800-316-5271. Call now.
Life insurance is one of those things that just about everybody needs, but few people actually have. Hey, if you die unexpectedly without life insurance, guess what? You'll leave your family with even a bigger mess. Life insurance will help replace your family's income. It'll help cover burial expenses. Life insurance can even help pay off debt like credit cards and medical bills. Life insurance can even pay for college. And if you own a business and you die, life insurance can help your business from collapsing. It can even help cover estate taxes. Life insurance has never been more affordable and needed. Plus, you can always shop around even if you have a plan and save some money. So call the Life Insurance Quote Line right now for free pricing information.
800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. That's 800-915-9658.
Do you owe $10,000 or more on at least two federal student loans? Then you may qualify for new programs offered by the Department of Education. These programs can reduce your interest, lower your payments, and possibly qualify you for loan forgiveness. If you have $10,000 or more and at least two federal student loans and currently not in school, you may qualify for one of these programs. Call now to check your eligibility. Student loan advisors are standing by to help you determine if you qualify for these new programs. They can help you reduce your interest, lower your payment, and even forgive a portion of your student loan debt. Take control of your financial future. Make this free 5-minute free call now to Nationwide Student Loans and learn how you can reduce your student loan debt.
800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Fordham Law Professor and China expert Carl Minzer. Before we dive into these indicators of decline, I want to get you to summarize, what did the reform era look like? I know that China was known for entrepreneurship and moving rural to urban. Give us a sense of what that big growth period looked like.
Sure. And in fact, I think one of the easiest ways to think about it is to contrast the reform era, the post-1978 era, with what came before. If you're thinking about the first three decades of China's, you know, the People's Republic of China, the Maoist era, China was politically unstable. This was the era in which, you know, Mao, you know, he purged people left and right. He purged his own two successors, one who died in a prison cell, the other who perished in a mysterious plane crash in Mongolia. Economically, China was pursuing a failed state-run economic model. Growth, you know, stagnated for several decades. And ideologically, China was relatively closed. This was an era in which Soviet revisionist practices and Western capitalism, as well as Chinese tradition itself, were all equally denounced. The reform era, when Deng Xiaoping came to the helm late 1970, China moved in a different direction. Economically, market reforms opened up China. And that sort of allowed the seeds of capitalism to sprout, allowed entrepreneurship, and basically fueled 3 to 4 decades of 10% GDP growth, in which China became sort of the engine of the world, which we know today. That was in turn based on core political reforms. Deng, himself having experienced the chaos and instability of the Maoist era, decided he wanted to take the country in a different direction. He decided within the party itself, we need to have collective leadership. We need to move away from one-man rule. He himself eschewed anything that looked like a cult of personality, which Mao had cultivated. He also sought to rule the country through sort of more stable institutions, use law rather than internally build up legal institutions as a way of stabilizing the system. And ideologically, he opened up China. He said, look, famously, even if some flies come in, we have to open the windows and let fresh air in. So he began to welcome sort of interchanges and exchanges with the outside. Those three things, that sort of openness to the outer external world, the rapid economic development, and the relative political stability, those were the key characteristics of the reform era, and I'm seeing all of them start to go.
And it ties in with Nixon's visit, doesn't it? Exactly. When they started to open up. It seemed like from reading these back and forth that there's some sort of self-destructive DNA in China that they make a great leap forward and then they make a big step back.
Well, I do think that one of the core reasons, and of course not all of the shifts that I'm seeing now are solely related to political. I do think there are economic shifts that are secular in nature. Mm-hmm. It is just the result of a country slowing down after rapid growth. But I do think that this failure to undertake deeper reform when they had the ability to do it, you know, I sense that in the 80s and 90s, there would have been this possibility to launch a more thoroughgoing reform of the political institutions. But particularly because that door got closed, at the point which the current leader, Xi Jinping, decides he needs to begin to more dramatically shake up the system, His only alternative is to begin to take the country back, to use the levers that he does know, and that kind of begins to lead to the political system cannibalizing.
I would look at some of these indicators of decline, starting with economic growth, obviously, and as you talked about, they had 10% growth for 30 years. Most recently, it's been under 7%, which would look good to us, but not
Absolutely.
To them. And their
right.
debt, their debt is almost 300% of GDP, which is pretty dangerous, if you ask me. Is the debt level untenable? Is their whole economy, you hear all this stuff that, and actually I think in your book too, that the real growth rate is 3%. There's so much phonying up going on, and these state-owned enterprises are big bureaucratic, you know, slow-moving guys. Talk about the decline on the economic side.
So the economic, this is an area where I'm not as strong as others. So I'm relying on some of the things that I hear from
right.
other people. But at a minimum, you know that the country is slowing itself. This is something Chinese leaders themselves flag. Even if you're reliant on the official GDP numbers, those are now, the Chinese authorities themselves are now setting a 6.5% growth rate going forward. And they're clearly recognizing that they can't pursue the same type. They had a stimulus-led expansion that essentially allowed them to surmount the effect of the global financial crisis. But the effect of that was, as you know, this really heavy buildup in GDP numbers. And the people that I talk to, who I find credible, tend to think that this is the rate of that expansion of debt is really serious. Certainly, if you look at the acts that Chinese authorities themselves are taking, they seem to think this is a big problem. I tend to lean more on the pessimistic side about the sustainability of this. And I feel that some of the actions that I'm seeing Chinese authorities take themselves are really indicating that they're very, very worried about how stable this could be in the long run.
Am I right on this stat that I think I got out of your book? Two-thirds of Chinese millionaires have emigrated?
I think it's emigrated or planned to do so.
That's
pretty if you look at the property prices and sort of who's, over the last couple of years, who's been buying, the flows of money into New York, into San Francisco, into L.A., as well as other countries, as well, Vancouver, you are definitely seeing the group of people with the most to lose if something really went wrong, beginning to make. They're diversifying their assets. They're making an opportunity. They're trying to put some of their money and their children potentially overseas, and that indicates to me that there's also a little bit of the confidence in the system among that group of people is also undergoing a shift.
What about the scope of corruption? I get this sense of like their version of crony capitalism is really going. The railway minister who has 18 mistresses, 350 apartments, 100 million in cash, has the country really lost its moral compass?
Yeah, I mean, certainly by the end of the Hu Jintao era, so around late 2008, 2012, corruption was rampant. And this was one of the things that when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, 2013, he realized this was a real problem for the party itself, because when the corruption sets into the fabric of the party, you really worry about your ability to sort of effectively run the country. And remember, China is a closed one-party authoritarian state. We've got our own version of corruption,
yeah.
But a good chunk of it is sort of, it's people, registered lobbyists making donations above the board. You know what's going on. In China, all that stuff was going on behind the scenes. And so when Xi Jinping decided, I need to figure out how to, get a handle on this, he said, I've really got to crack down on the party itself and, really threw the party into a very intense anti-corruption purge.
Is the anti-corruption purge, is it real?
That's a very good question. And, some people say, oh, it's all fake. It's only aimed at getting rid of Xi Jinping's allies. I don't think it's that simple. I think at the top level, it's been a very effective tool to do exactly that, to sort of go after people who were associated with, for example, Xi Jinping's immediate predecessors and basically sideline some of those folks. But I do think there's an element of it which the aim is to suppress or at least push down the manifestations of corruption so that the population at large doesn't believe that the party itself is just rotten to the core. The problem in a relatively closed system is, how do you do that if you don't really have any independent checks on power? You can have a really fierce purge. You can tell everybody, don't be corrupt. But how do you monitor that? And how do you ensure that know, that's the fundamental. Who monitors the monitors in China? That's one of the problems they're dealing with, and one of the reasons why I think it's very hard to sort of systematically wipe out corruption in a relatively closed one-party system like China.
We'll look more at the President for Life when we come back with our third segment.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who can't work because of a serious injury or illness, you may be eligible for disability benefits from Social Security. Receiving benefits is your right. It doesn't matter if you've applied before and the government has said no. Let the experienced attorneys at Bill Gordon & Associates help you get the Social Security disability you deserve. Their team of attorneys have been fighting for benefits for people just like you for over 20 years. And best of all, there's no fee until you receive your benefits. There are many conditions that make you eligible, including some you may not even be aware of. So if you're disabled and unable to work, call Bill Gordon and Associates today for your free no-obligation consultation. See if you qualify for the Social Security benefits you need and deserve. 800-470-4453. 800-470-4453. That's 800-470-4453.
If you're over the age of 50 and considering buying an annuity in the next 60 days, I have some important news for you. Don't buy an annuity until you understand the pros and cons of annuities. A free book to help you maximize your retirement income from television host and three-time author Josh Melberg has been released. This book reveals little-known truths about annuity strategies in simple-to-understand terms. Grab a pen right now because we are about to offer you this free book that unlocks the five little-known secrets we believe baby boomers and seniors should know before buying an annuity. Call 800-935-0752 now and you'll receive a free copy of Josh Melberg's book, Next Gen Annuity Strategies Revealed. As a bonus, we'll also send you a copy of The Number One Mistakes Retirees Are Making with Their Investments Today and a free DVD on how you can get up to 33% more income in retirement. Call 800-935-0752. That's 800-935-0752. Employees of J.D. Melberg Financial have the appropriate licenses for the products they offer.
Tired of paying outrageous prices for Viagra? Well, we have great news for you. Now you can finally get Viagra at huge discounts. Healthy Man allows you to save up to $500 on Viagra. Why pay U.S. pharmacy prices of $15 per pill or more when you can get Viagra for less than $3 a pill? Call today and get 40 Viagra pills for only $99. This can cost as much as $600 at your local pharmacy. You can't afford not to call us. If you want Viagra at the lowest prices, never pay $15 a pill pharmacy prices again. Get Viagra for less than $3 a pill. Call 1-800-521-9579 today and save up to $500 and get 40 pills for just $99. Healthy Man is fast, easy, and affordable. Operators are waiting at 1-800-521-9579 to take your call right now. Call 1-800-521-9579. That's 1-800-521-9579. Again, 1-800-521-9579.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-569-3414. That's 800-569-3414. Again, 800-569-3414.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures, is offering buildings at prices
prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices. A 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right. That's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370. 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're talking with the author of End of an Era, How China's Authoritarian Revival is Undermining Its Rise. That's Carl Minzer, professor of law at the Fordham University Law School. I'm interested in this issue because it's become a big issue here as well. What is the increasing income inequality doing to China? And they had made a big effort, right, to improve the rural conditions or move them to the cities. And it seems like all those things are coming to a halt, as you talk about it.
That's a really good question. I mean, sort of, you know, one of the striking features about China's reform era is of course the lifting, you know, many, many people, hundreds of millions of people getting out of poverty. And that's one of the, you know, crucial successes of the reform era. China, you know, which you people used to group with India and other much less developed countries, has affirmatively pulled itself out of into a different class. And a big part of that was in the 1980s, the early reforms, the opening, allowed large numbers of people to escape rural poverty and, you know, improve their well-being. But there's been a real shift over the last 20 or 30 years, since the early 1990s. Increasingly, what's happened in China is there's been a much greater split. Again, similar to what you see in other countries, too. You flagged the United States, which is true. You've seen that gap between the, you know, ordinary people and then the really rich, as well as the urban class. That gap has increased quite substantially. So China's Gini coefficient, which is this measure of inequality between rich and poor, which used to be sort of on the more equal level, has really surged. So it's now up there with the most unequal societies in the world. And that's feeding a lot of resentment. I mean, certainly, you know, when you see the Mercedes-Benz of the extremely wealthy guy go shooting by, when you as a migrant worker in the urban area have trouble getting your kids into the local schools because you're being discriminated against because your residency status isn't urban, and when you can't afford to have your kids enjoy the same privileges, it feeds a level of resentment within society that is definitely building up.
It's interesting that they don't really have insight to the negative impact of what they're doing. And maybe you could say the same about our gridlock. But let's talk about President Xi now. What are his plans in a broad sense? You use the term ideological patterns from Mao. Talk about him.
Well, so I think he comes to power in 2012 and 2013, and he sees a political system around him that's, as you mentioned, you know, deeply pervaded. The money and power fused together into this real corrupt, you know, body of the money and power become fused together in a real tight network of corruption. He's worried about, he's looking at the Hu Jintao administration that came before him. He sees a sort of factionalized system where you have power divided between a range of different people, and he's worried about the future of the country. He's also probably worried about what his own position is going to be. And I think he decides that the only way to take the system forward is to begin to break down the norms that have governed, to begin to re-centralize power himself, and to try to restore the party itself to like a real revolutionary, real meaningful place within the system where it's no longer just water cooler banter. It becomes something that people take seriously again. And so there are a couple different components of what he does. One is, as we were just discussing, re-centralize power in myself, shake up the system, but then also really try to begin to revive the party ideologically. Part of it, you know, involving, let's bring back, you know, some of the resonance with Mao. Let's start remembering the good old days. But the other thing he does, which is this is the ideologically the interesting thing, is he's beginning to pivot back to China's own past. China's Communist Party, quite logically enough, if you remember in the 20th century, was trying to wipe out Chinese tradition. They didn't like Confucius. They didn't like any of China's tradition. They were a revolutionary party that was going to break with all of that. Now it's the reverse. You know, Xi Jinping is taking the Communist Party back to the imperial period. He's beginning to figure out, say, we need to take Confucianism and Buddhism and some of, you know, China's tradition and fuse it with Marxist-Leninism and nationalism into a new ideology which will take China forward. And that, for somebody who looks at China in the long term, this is a really interesting thing that the Communist Party is beginning to try to re-embrace Confucius.
Let me ask about this now. Hong Kong has been sort of a capitalist model state. What's going to happen to them?
That, I think, is that's another real hotbed. I mean, that's potentially going to be a real problem. So Hong Kong, of course, since it came back to the formerly British colony, since it came back to mainland China in the late 1990s, it's been governed under this one country, two systems approach, in which they have been allowed to maintain all of their own common law traditions, a relatively high level of independent autonomy from mainland China. But that has now begun to come under increasing pressure. And it's come under increasing pressure because of Chinese authorities have, about 10 years ago, they decided they needed to start to push patriotic education more, you know, reminding Hong Kongers that you really are Chinese and don't forget that. That then generated a blowback where you started to see identity within Hong Kong among Cantonese-speaking youth begin to get radicalized, where people say, no, you know, we're different from mainland China. We have our own democratic system, more democratic, certainly more individual rights than exist in mainland China. And you started mobilization around that. The Occupy Central movement in 2014, which, you know, followed with the Occupy Wall Street, was a group of, you know, young people basically taking to the streets to say, you know, we reject the pressure that's being brought by mainland China, and we want to sort of stay with and reassert our own identity as well as our own more democratic institutions in Hong Kong itself. In the last couple of years, that's now generated significant blowback from Beijing. So Beijing now seems to believe in order to address this problem, they need to clamp down even tighter on Hong Kong. So pressure has now been mounting in a range of institutions and in the form of Beijing beginning to reinterpret the basic law that governs Hong Kong. They maintain that nothing's going to change, but it does look to me like this back and forth between Hong Kong and mainland China is beginning to lead to an erosion in Hong Kong's special status. And certainly for your readers, the business community, I think that at some point starts to raise questions about the rule of law in Hong Kong and what it might mean for Hong Kong's institutional identity going forward.
Now, you say that normally when a country reaches between 2,000 and 5,000 of per capita income and China's at 6,000, it's more of a chance that a success to transition to democracy can happen. And you talk about the South Korean and Taiwan models. You don't see China making that, though.
No. So, I mean, that's the folks, these poli-sci folks who sort of look at transitions have had this theory that, you know, when societies get to a certain level of economic development, they just automatically transition away from an authoritarian model to sort of a more open model. And I think for many people, that had been the way they were thinking China was. They're saying, well, you know, even in the 80s and 90s, yeah, China's a one-party system, but it's naturally, if it gets wealthier, is going to become more open. And that hasn't happened. I mean, the interesting thing is China is now economically at the level that, you know, South Korea or Taiwan was at the point when they began their democratic transition in the late 1980s, and that hasn't happened. And in fact, I think that, you know, the shift has been more fundamental. I think the real changes that began in South Korea and Taiwan happened much earlier. I think if you look at the trajectory of the democratic transition in both of those countries, certain changes even happened in the 70s and 80s, well before military rule was lifted in either of those countries, that facilitated the transition to a more open system. And if I look back at a corresponding period in China, which is to say the last 10 to 20 years since the late 1990s or early 1980s, what I see in China is all of the doors that could have been opened, all of the limited reforms, village democracy, administrative law reforms, that might have been taken at an earlier stage to facilitate that transition, all of those things got shut down. So not only is China, you know, now beginning to shift in a more hardline direction, but they closed down all the doors that might have permitted a more stable transition in other countries.
About a minute to go. Are there any models, any countries out there that you see that look like what China is going to end up?
That's where I really hate predicting. Because, you know, look, China's huge. It's very unique. It has its own path. But I do, when I start thinking about this question, I invariably start getting drawn, as I say, these other countries, which were hardline countries that successfully transitioned. And if I conclude that China doesn't look like those, I end up starting to look at other countries which pursued more open reforms and then moved against them. Late 19th century Russia is an interesting one, where there was a period of a reform era for about 20 years in 1865, 1885, and then they basically turned against their own reforms, shut the doors down, became much autocratic, and the effect of that was to radicalize society. And, you know, it wasn't like the system failed immediately, but it did mean that it set things up for a very rocky transition at the early 20th century that kind of went in exactly the wrong direction you would hope a country might go to.
Looking at the future of China next, our final segment.
As a small business owner, there's one word that you absolutely dread: payroll. For small businesses, it's a big burden. You may think you're saving time and money doing it yourself. But come on, are you? Timesheets, processing checks, calculating taxes, a total waste of your time. Paychex simplifies payroll processing, saving you time and money. Submit your payroll online, fax it in, or call your dedicated Paychex payroll specialist. And you're done. Learn more at TryPaychex.com. Come on, do the math. The IRS dishes out 8 million penalties a year. Make one mistake and you're on the hook. On average, you're losing nearly one business day every month doing payroll. That's time and money you'll never get back, unless you get Paychex. More than 500,000 small businesses already do. Call 877-649-5324. Trade payroll pressure for peace of mind. Call now. 877-649-5324. That's 877-649-5324.
If you're suffering from hearing loss, stay tuned for a special offer from the makers of Listen Clear, a revolutionary hearing aid breakthrough designed by top audio engineers to fit your ear almost invisibly. Right now, you can try Listen Clear hearing aids absolutely free for 45 days. You can also qualify for free shipping and free batteries for life. Listen Clear hearing aids are so lightweight and comfortable, you can wear them all day long. They're practically invisible, too, so others won't even notice you're wearing them. And the best part is, you'll be able to hear almost everything, everywhere. So do something about your hearing loss. Call Listen Clear now to get started with your 45-day risk-free hearing aid trial. This special offer won't be available for long, so call Listen Clear now.
800-716-4650. 800-716-4650. 800-716-4650. We're here 24 hours a day to help. That's 800-716-4650.
National Funding Group has just released $100 million in easy access small business funding to businesses that gross at least $100,000 a year. You can have fast access up to $500,000 in new business capital in as little as 48 hours. Think about the ways you could grow your business if you had up to a $500,000 cash infusion. Call a NFG funding expert now. The process is easy. It only takes about 5 minutes. Then our management-owned lending team looks at your application for a fast approval. You can get 100% funded in about 2 days. If you need up to $500,000 in working capital to run your business and you gross at least $100,000 a year, call NFG and apply today. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. That's 800-296-1564.
Do you have an old car sitting in your driveway? How would you like to learn a hassle-free way to get rid of it, help kids in need, and get a great tax donation in the process? It's real easy. One simple free call to our car donation hotline is all it takes. Call the Neshama Foundation
at 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723.
We'll come pick your car up for free and give you a tax donation for the full value of the car, running or not. The value of your unwanted car will go to help kids in need. It's fast and easy. Just call us and your car will be gone and on its way to helping children in 48 hours. And you get a nice tax deduction. Call the Neshama Foundation now to get rid of your car, help kids, and get a tax write-off.
Call 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. That's 800-721-6723.
Got an old car? You can donate it, whether it's running or not, to the United Breast Cancer Foundation and save a life. They'll even come and pick it up for free. The United Breast Cancer Foundation has saved hundreds of women's lives through their free or low-cost breast screen exams. But now they need your help. The United Breast Cancer Foundation wants to save more lives through early detection by offering women free or low-cost breast screening exams. And donating your old car, SUV, or truck, whether it's running or not, helps pay for them. Plus, you get a charitable tax deduction. Help the United Breast Cancer Foundation save lives by donating your old car, SUV, or truck. Call now for free pickup. 800-245-0473, 800-245-0473, 800-245-0473. Call right now. That number again is 800-245-0473.
Biz Talk Radio.
Chinese law and governance expert Carl Minzer in our final national segment. Do you see any chance of regime collapse at some point and any chance that there'll be a radicalization of the people?
So, I mean, you know, there's nothing on the horizon right now that signals regime collapse is imminent. The party has strong control over China. It has lots of resources. The economy is still rapidly growing. So, there are people out there who sort of are the China bears will say, the collapse is imminent. I'm not one of those people. I don't know exactly what will happen, but the book is aimed at flagging a series of pressures that just seem to me to be building up within the system. So in the short run, it looks to me like this turn towards a more authoritarian, a more hardline approach is going to gradually erode the democratic capacities of the state. When you're thinking of the reformer, everyone thinks of China today, you think of China as being a very effectively managed country. You think of, it's an authoritarian state, but it's well-run. And you think, hey, and that's an artifact of the reformer. That's an artifact of the late 1970s, early 1980s, where the party was backing out of everybody's lives. It was saying, we're going to only control the big decisions. We're going to let the technocratic managers begin to run things. We'll let businesses have a lot more leeway to do what we want to do. The problem is, as the power gets concentrated in the hands of a narrower range of people, then you start to worry about bad decisions happening. You worry about things like a big stock market run up in 2015 and then the breakdown, where you had the sense the system was not responding as capably. And I just think the risks of that start to increase as power centralizes even more closely. And as the system becomes more ideologically tight, I think the pressures also start to ramp up on people who used to think, well, politics didn't involve me. You've had within the last couple months now some foreign businesses, domestic Chinese businesses as well, have to issue self-criticisms for things that were on their website if they listed Taiwan incorrectly. And I worry that some of those pressures might also start to build up again. And that starts in the short term to erode the way the system is running. If things really started to become more problematic, might some of those latent social pressures that have built up over a range of, over 30 years, as mm-hmm. China has gone through the most extreme social transitions of any country in the world. I mean, the development trajectory, the changes that the United States and Europe range of other countries experienced over the course of 200 or 300 years, massive urbanization, huge development. That's all been compressed in China to 30 years. But the the resulting political pressures, the social pressures, they've kind of been, the lid's been kept on those because of China's political system. If there were problems that started to emerge, might some of those pressures come out? This, again, I'm not saying, oh, that's everyone wants democracy. I'm just saying that there are a lot of people who are angry or upset or don't think that they got what was deserving to them or are irritated about, you know, government. I mean, there's a complex mixture of pressures that are under the surface there. And I just worry if the political system started to have cracks in it, what might happen as a result. And I'm much more worried than I think other people are about that.
Interesting.
Possibility.
Is there a chance that social media could undermine the authoritarianism?
Well, at the moment, I mean, certainly in the late 1990s, Bill Clinton said, well, there's no way anyone could ever control the Internet. I mean, nailing Jell-O to the wall. Well, the Chinese nailed Jell-O to the wall. the Great Firewall managed to, they saw media as a problem, and they have come up with an effective censorship system. So I don't think that there are technologists out there who sort of think, well, the technology will inevitably change. I think that the state can respond to that. I think some of that will just depend on the deeper political shifts that are going on.
Should the U.S. be pushing for regime change? Should we be pushing for getting more of our consumer services in there and working with them? Are they an ally? What are they?
Yeah, I'm not in the regime change ranks. I mean, I think that the United States has to be very careful about becoming over-identified with a particular regime, and I think we also need to be careful about aggressively beginning to try to topple other regimes. I think both of those can work out very negatively. If you become over-identified with a particular regime, including China, then the people who are in that society who are unhappy with their government start to look at you as a problem. Look at what happened to Iran after the Shah fell. All of a sudden, we started to become identified as the person who was closely identified with the Shah. But conversely, if you sort of topple the country, if you sort of aggressively become involved in toppling the government, it may not work out the way you want. You probably don't have that much ability to influence events after the fact anyway. And why would you want to do this? And then that you look at what we've just been done in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's very complicated too. So I'm really hesitant to push anybody in either one of those directions. For me, I think it comes down to, first we have to get our act together at home. I think we in the United States have to stand up for our own liberal democracy. I think we're suffering political erosion in our own system. China's one-party system is experiencing top-down political erosion where its norms are coming undone. We in the United States are experiencing bottom-up political erosion as a result of bottom-up populism. And I think, first we need to get our own house in order, and we have to stand up for liberal values to the extent that we can, and I think it's by virtue of being standing up for what we represent and speaking about it. I certainly think we can also speak about our how important liberal democracy is. But that's certainly more convincing when you're actually practiced. So that would be one thing that I would encourage us to do in the United States.
All right, we got a minute to go. Is the worst case that we go back into a Cold War kind of relations and trade wars? And are you overall optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm really worried. I think that, and this isn't just about China. I mean, I definitely think that China is beginning to slide in the negative direction, and I really worry that it's unpredictable how far that can go. I'm worried also because at the same time in the United States, as I mentioned, that slide that we're experiencing, I think that's leading both countries to essentially become more hardline ethno-nationalist. Both countries perhaps becoming more wary of free trade, both countries becoming more wary of the other, at least particularly in the leadership ranks. And I think that could lead to some real tension between the two countries. In the long run, I really hope that sort of people in both countries who kind of think that, openness to the outside, think that exchanges with the other, think that, multinational organizations have a role to play. I think people in both countries need to stand up for those values. And it's easier, of course, in the United States because we have a democratic system that allows for that. In China, it's going to be very difficult for those voices to get out in this environment. But hopefully in the United States, some of us can stand up for that.
been a sobering look at China. Looks like you're ahead of the curve on everything here. Thanks to Carl Menser. That book, again, is End of an Era, How China's Authoritarian Revival is Undermining Its Rise. It's just out. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Fordham Law's Carl Menser. Thanks to our national audience for listening. See everybody next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com.
Biz Talk Radio.